This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Kayla Williams is now out of the Army, but that doesn't mean she's through thinking about it and living out the consequences of her time in combat. Williams served a year in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. As an Arabic linguist, she traveled across the country working with different American units and interacting directly with the Iraqi people. Often she was the only woman among American troops. She respected many of the men she served with. She also observed shocking incompetence, cultural ignorance. She was sexually insulted, and she participated in forceful interrogations of Iraqi detainees. After she came home, she wrote a memoir about her experiences. The book is Love My Rifle More Than You, a young and female in the U.S. Army. And Kayla Williams is with us in the studio. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 877-962-9862 as I discuss with Kayla Williams what it is like to be a woman in the military and what it is like for anyone to serve in combat these days, and in particular in Iraq. 877-962-9862. How different is it? How difficult is it to be a woman in the military these days?
It's a tough question to answer because I think so much of it is personal. It is tougher to be a woman in today's army than it is to be a man. Just across the board, it's generally more physically challenging, and it's incredibly frustrating to be a minority, which in a lot of ways means that you represent all others of your kind, and all others of your kind represent you. So if I make a mistake, it's not just me, but all women are making this mistake. And so that pressure alone can be much more frustrating. But at the same time, it's tough for everyone. It's not like it's an incredibly easy experience for men to go through. So,
well, it is a difficult experience, as you describe in your book. And as I look at we want to talk certainly about the being a woman, the sexual harassment, and all of those things that you've spoken about, that you've written about. But I was actually taken more in this book, believe it or not, by the incompetence that you met up with in sort of prosecuting this war. And cultural ignorance. It seems as though a lot of the folks who are out there in contact every day with Iraqis don't know where they are and don't know who they're dealing with.
That certainly was how I felt quite often while I was over there. And I got out of the Army in June, but I know that even before I got out, the Army was trying to apply the lessons learned. They were trying to do better. They had cultural awareness and cultural sensitivity classes. So they were making the effort. Unfortunately, there's at this point, at least among troops that have already been, especially a certain amount of anger and a lack of desire to become culturally sensitive. Who cares about being sensitive to these people's feelings? They're trying to kill us. So the Army's trying, but it's an uphill battle.
And you got in 2003. The notion originally was that we were going to go in as liberators and everyone would welcome us. And now you talk about an attitude among soldiers that, look, these folks are trying to kill us. We really don't need to know about them. Have you talked to folks who were there initially? And do you get a sense that the feelings, at least among the troops, U.S. troops, about the population have changed over time?
They changed while I was there. There was the initial combat, and then once that was declared over, there was a sort of lull for a while when things weren't that bad and there seemed to be some hope. And then for whatever reasons that are debated endlessly, and some of them seemed apparent even at the time, and some of them maybe we were all blindsided by, but things began to get bad again. There was an upswing, and it was at that point that we had already been there for about 6 months, and at that time we were getting frustrated. We wanted to go home, and then coupling our frustration with the upswing in violence, it definitely created a lot of anger within the troops themselves.
Was everyone blindsided, or you know, were there commanding officers, were there more senior officers who said, you know, we saw this coming, we knew this was going to happen? I don't know how they thought it wasn't.
I was at a low level, and I certainly cannot speak to what was going on at the highest levels. But definitely, even from where I was, there were times when I thought that it was going to get worse. There were things that I saw when they happened and thought, this can't be a good idea. Dismissing the entire army, the Iraqi army, it did not seem like a good idea, even to me, and I was at a very low level. Yeah. And certain other things that I could see what would lead to problems. And I could hear what the Iraqi people were talking about being frustrated by. I mean, they're still to this day angry about the looting that happened. They were frustrated while it was going on and begging us to stop looting and stop problems. But it was incredibly difficult. There were very few people who spoke Arabic there. And so incredibly hard to walk into a neighborhood and not know who's from there, who isn't, not know who to believe. And the people wanted us to immediately be police and mediators and restore electricity and do everything all at once. And the fact that we simply couldn't, you could see the seeds of anger being planted right away.
You are an Arab linguist and served as a translator. Tell us a little bit more about your job.
I did signals intelligence, which means that I did intercept on enemy communications and would then theoretically be able to translate them as well.
So you're in a position to help mediate in a lot of ways between the troops and the local population.
Well, no, I was intercepting enemy communications. I was not an interpreter, which actually isn't a job in the Army. There is no such job. There's my job, which is signals intelligence. It's a little more technical. And then there's the human intelligence side of things, which is more interrogators. But just being someone to translate, it isn't really a position that the Army has. And after combat operations were over, many more civilian interpreters were hired. Both people who were living in America and even locals in Iraq were hired to translate. But it's a difficult position because you can never quite be sure where loyalties lie.
That seems odd that the Army wouldn't have interpreters going along on these military operations. Seems like a pretty important function.
I empathize with the Army, though, because my training took 2 years, and how many languages do you want to have a vast pool of translators just waiting in case there's a conflict? Right. Once you decide there's going to be a conflict, sure, you can try to ramp up the number of people being trained in a foreign language, but to have people trained for just that reason, just to translate, if you don't know whether or not an actual conflict is going to kick off, would be a huge expense. What I think makes more sense is for the Army to try to increase the number of people who have that as a secondary ability, to try to encourage more officers and enlisted soldiers to have languages that they can use in addition to their primary job, whatever their primary mission is, to just be able to always help out. To briefly go on my soapbox, I think that would help America in general if our public school system would increase the number of people learning foreign languages in general.
Yeah, it makes the study of language that much easier, I would think, even if you wanted to branch out and study a different language. I also found it interesting that you were able to study Arabic and then it more or less lapsed. I mean, you didn't use it, and there's no sort of brush up policy to keep you current in the language. So by the time you got there, you lost most of what you learned.
Oh, the policies are there. It's just the implementation that can fall short when you have so many other things that are an important part of the mission as well. You have to keep current on your technical skills, and then there are the crucial important things like making sure that, you know, all the gravel's in the right place on the Army base. And making sure that you're working on your trucks and that you keep your marksmanship skills up. It's incredibly difficult to try to be skilled and on top of everything at once and maintain your language ability, because language is such an incredibly perishable skill.
Sure.
It was also incredibly frustrating as an Arabic linguist to be out there, you know, picking weeds out of the gravel and know that the FBI was complaining about this horrible lack of qualified Arabic linguists with security clearance to translate this huge backlog, and think, you know, why can't I be doing that and keeping current on my language skills and helping the bigger national community? But there's the problem of everybody has their turf.
Yeah. Well, to illustrate this, I'd like to read a little bit. Kayla Williams is my guest today, and her book is Love My Rifle More Than You, about her experiences in the Army and in Iraq. Set this up for us. This is when you are trying to clear a monastery, and language skills certainly play a part in this.
Yes. This was at a time when, because there were not enough civilian interpreters, I was going out with the infantry and translating between infantry commanders and the civilian population. We are in an area of Baghdad called Dura. It is quite lovely. Trees, orchards, homes inside walled compounds. The doors, as in most of Iraq, are elaborately designed and often blue. We go in the back of the compound. The grounds are lush, well-tended and groomed. around to the front of the building, which is beautiful and clean to a degree that is surprising. Amazingly, the UN embargo and the ravages of two wars have somehow spared it. We knock, and a man in robes ushers us inside. In Arabic, I repeat my by-now standard questions. We must search this building for weapons. Do you have any weapons here, or caches of weapons and ammunition? The monk is polite. He smiles. He responds in English. We have nothing to hide, he says. I'm happy to show you our church. However, some of the rooms are locked. The man with the keys is leading prayers in a small room. There, he points to his right. Perhaps you can search those rooms later, when prayers are done? The lieutenant in charge of this mission is looking at me. I look back at him. We are all silent for a moment. Specialist Williams, the lieutenant says. Sir? I respond, uncertain. The monk stands there, a model of serenity and calm. What did this guy just say? I glance at the monk, but his expression does not change. He says that they are in the middle of prayers, and the man with the key to the locked rooms is leading the prayers. When they finish prayers, he can show us the locked rooms. Oh, the lieutenant says. Okay. But I can't take this. He's speaking English, sir. You can ask him anything you want. The lieutenant is uninterested in hearing my views. Is it possible that the lieutenant cannot understand the monk simply because he looks foreign?
Kayla Williams reading from Love My Rifle More Than You. We want to talk a little bit more about the cultural difficulties and also the difficulties in being a woman, some of the harassment that you experienced, and your experiences in interrogation as well, interrogation of some of the detainees and prisoners in Iraq. On the state of things, we're talking today with Kayla Williams, author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Support for the state of things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Kayla Williams joined the military in January of 2000 in what, as she writes in her memoir, was still Bill Clinton's America. She joined the Army Reserves and trained as an Arabic interpreter and spent a year in Iraq. She's written about the experience in a book called Love My Rifle More Than You. Kayla Williams is in the studio today. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Your book goes into detail, Kayla, about the sexual taunting and harassment that you received from other soldiers. And you sort of took that to be a normal part of the military experience.
Yes, and I think it's actually fairly common and widespread in many parts of American life, especially when you have younger men. Yeah.
But the numbers are far different. The proportions are different, and that seemed to be a part of what's at stake here, what's at play here.
Definitely, that plays into it. Being in a man's world is certainly makes it easier. But I guess I've been surprised at how shocked everyone seems that it's a problem. I mean, you have a bunch of guys, many of whom are between 18 and 25. Of course it's on their minds. And in the military, I would say men are just more honest. They're more willing to speak very bluntly about what they're thinking and not, they don't hide things as much. They don't try to put on a polite way of speaking about something. They're just very blunt about what they're thinking, what's going through their minds at any given moment. And certainly it was incredibly frustrating at times, but also it was easier to deal with the fact that it was out in the open than if it had been kind of sublimated or hidden.
Well, but doesn't it put you in a difficult position? I mean, you talk about a time on the Hill where, you know, the guys are all sitting around asking you to expose yourself. That puts you in a difficult position, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I won't pretend that it wasn't incredibly frustrating in a lot of ways, but you know, I had that experience in New Orleans when I was at Mardi Gras once. So I guess it didn't seem so completely shocking to me that, you know, men are in fact interested in seeing female breasts.
I just wonder if the military at all, I mean, you know, remember the argument going into this. One of the arguments about not having women in the service was that this is going to be disruptive. It's going to be difficult. Boys will be boys, and that's not going to change. And in combat situations where stress is higher, boys will be even worst behaved, so maybe we just shouldn't have them in uniform.
I can tell you that the problems did not arise until combat was over. When I was actually going out and translating for these infantry soldiers in Baghdad, they never treated me with any disrespect. They always treated me absolutely as a professional and respected me for being able to do my job and help them accomplish the mission. Months later, when I would see them, they would say, "Hey, you are our linguist in Baghdad." Whereas soldiers in other units who did not see me doing my actual mission would say, "Hey, you're that chick that was with us in, you know, Najaf or wherever." So it wasn't until we were in this situation where it was much more safe and stable and secure. Mm. We were on the side of a mountain in one of, at that point, one of the safest places in Iraq with a lot of downtime and nothing to do. And that's when these things really came to the forefront and became problematic, became issues. When you're doing your mission constantly and you're always out there doing the actual job, you're not thinking about sex as much as when you're sitting around with nothing to do for hours at a time waiting to work your regularly scheduled shift.
Well, and you talked about how you're surprised that anybody's shocked that this would be the case. The other surprising side of this was you talked about a D company commander where you experienced no harassment and none of this sort of thing. You attributed it to the leadership of that particular unit.
I think that was definitely part of it. Command climate can play an important role in what's going on. And I think that he was just an outstanding leader who was well-respected by his troops, and that had a lot to do with it. But also, again, part of it was that it was that Delta Company, 1st the 187, that I was going out with a lot on actual missions in Baghdad doing my mission. But definitely, individual commanders can have a huge impact on how their soldiers treat anybody that they come into contact with. If you have a commander who encourages their soldiers to at all times shoot first and ask questions later or kick down doors, then you're going to have a lot of soldiers kicking down doors. But if you have a commander who encourages troops to go into things with a little more respect and at least knock first, then that's what's going to happen. Commanders can have a huge amount of impact on how their soldiers behave.
Let's go to the phone. Steve is on the line from Cary. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The point I wanted to make, and I'll take my reply offline, is there seems to be a disconnect between the civilian side and the reporters and so forth, their understanding of how the military functions. And what Kayla's pointing out with respect to age and youth, it certainly plays a part in the sexual harassment. It plays a part in how they act. I guess to ask Kayla to comment on the age of the individuals involved, the relative maturity level, and if just to point out to the listeners, I guess the best way to describe it is many of these individuals, the companies that are made up, imagine the high school football team being trained to shoot weapons and so forth, and then being taken out and asked to make these kind of life or death decisions. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Right, absolutely. The people that would tend to cross the line would be guys that were between about 18 and 24, 25 years old. So imagine, you know, the tail end of high school or in college, you know, fraternity, all these guys together in a group and encouraging each other, egging each other on. And certainly that can be very problematic. But again, I think, although it's easy to really focus on the areas where there are problems, they stand out and it's something that's so easy to pick up on. And I hope that it doesn't obscure the fact that I also served alongside some phenomenal people in circumstances where they were brave and hardworking in times of great hardship. And, you know, I did have an incident that was incredibly problematic on the side of the mountain, but I also met the man who's now my husband there and I've been incredibly lucky to serve around some really outstanding people.
But the conditions under which war is fought, and you talked about some of the attitudes that soldiers have toward now the civilian population. I mean, it is a requirement of war that you dehumanize the enemy. And I wonder what impact that has on you professionally and then later, now that you're out of the military.
That was incredibly difficult. I certainly understood the concept of trying to dehumanize the other. I can't imagine what it would be like to, you know, look at a man and think this is a husband, a brother, a father, a son, and then kill them. So you have to an extent, think of them as just the enemy. One of the things that makes Iraq so incredibly difficult is that We aren't just fighting a war. We aren't just in there facing the enemy. We're supposed to be helping the people. We're supposed to be helping rebuild their society. We were supposed to be liberating them from an oppressive tyrant. So to go into this situation where you're supposed to be trying to win the hearts and minds, but also protect yourself and not get killed, where you're dealing with everyone, you have to think of them as the enemy or potentially the enemy, but also as people that you're trying to help. And that's a painful line for soldiers to have to walk constantly. You can't let your guard down, but at the same time, if you are constantly on guard, the people are not going to trust you either. And that's really extremely difficult. And I tried very hard to not completely dehumanize the Iraqi people. I speak Arabic. I have friends who are Arabic, and they were human beings to me at all times, possibly especially because I could speak to them in their own language. But even I, towards the end, would just get angry and frustrated and just incredibly angry that we're trying to help and they're trying to kill us. And the worst thing to me is that even now I try to eavesdrop on Arabs in restaurants if I hear people speaking Arabic. And maybe that's partly just because I want to practice the language, but certainly there's a tiny part of me that is still suspicious of not just people of Arabic descent, but unfamiliar situations. To come home from being constantly on guard to, oh, you're in America, relax. It's not that easy. I still swerve to avoid trash in the road because it might be an IED. So,
You went out with a man who was Arabic. He was Saudi. And you talked
Palestinian.
Palestinian, forgive me. You talk about, in many cases, seeing his face or imagining him among those who you met in Iraq and how that had an influence on how you reacted and interacted with the people there.
Yes, absolutely. If I can be a little off topic and random, I just read an article the other day that said that in terms of how Americans perceive people of other races, the thing that has the biggest impact on how you perceive people of other races than your own is if you've had a romantic relationship. And that's stronger than friendship or anything else. So that may play into it, but definitely similar shapes of the eye. And I was just used to being around Arabic people when I joined the army. I was used to the culture, the fact that they stand much closer together when speaking than Americans. Americans have this huge sense of personal space. We want everyone at least at arm's length. And I didn't find it as threatening to have people wanting to be really close to me when talking because I was comfortable with it, familiar with it, and found some of the cultural traditions to be normal to me or something I was used to and found pleasant. The constant generosity and wanting to always give you food and something to drink. These were things that I found comforting in a way.
How much do you find, how much confusion is there among the soldiers who are on the ground in Iraq about their mission? I mean, you talked about having to walk this line. Do soldiers feel like they're walking a line, or do you have to just make a choice? We're here to kill. We're here to serve. It's one or the other. We just can't do both.
It's a tough question to answer. I've been back for a year and a half, so I cannot speak for what soldiers that are there right now are feeling. I know when I was there, it could vary by soldier and by day. People are out there passing out books to school children or distributing benzene or propane to the people, and then they're going on raids where they're kicking down doors and taking prisoners and looking for insurgents. And you know, you want to play with the local children and, you know, they'll go and buy you sodas and you want to like them. But at the same time, there's this constant sense of being on guard. Right. And soldiers that I knew, there were some soldiers, quite a few, actually, a disturbingly, depressingly high number who by 8 months into it or so thought we should just nuke the region. And I was so devastated to hear that. Let's just nuke the region. But I think that sense of not being completely clear on the mission, it certainly was a heavy part of a lot of my experience. The rules of engagement changed consistently. I mean, they just were changing all the time. And that sense of, why are we really here? What is our actual mission? Are we here to fight or are we here to help people? And that feeling of not knowing what the mission really is was pervasive.
Well, you talked about the frustration that that generates, a sense, oh, let's just nuke the region and get it over with. That's one. I would think there might be a sense of cynicism that would build in, too. And I don't know how much of that was there. You were there. You tell me whether at some point there's a feeling that, look, we were told one thing, and now I'm seeing something quite different. I was sold a bill of goods. Is that a pervasive feeling, or is that something you might project from over here?
The cynicism is definitely there in a lot of ways. When people would say they wanted to nuke the region, I would sometimes say, well, come on. I mean, what about the children? There are innocent children you would be killing. And they'd say, they're not innocent. They're just baby terrorists. And that horrified me. But the sense of that we were sent under false pretenses, that was something that I felt in quite a few of the soldiers that I served with and that I certainly felt. I mean, I was with a brigade that was in Afghanistan as well before Iraq, and everyone supported going into Afghanistan. I mean, the world community was very supportive of the U.S. going to Afghanistan, but Iraq, it felt like trying to connect Iraq to 9/11 was just ridiculous. And if we're there because of the human rights issue, why are we not in the Sudan? And it just felt like a very hypocritical or disingenuous war. And there may be very valid geopolitical reasons to go into Iraq, but I feel like if, since we are living in a democracy, it is important for the American people to be given the honest and true and valid reasons to do something instead of being given false or incomplete reasons for going into a war with such an incredibly high human toll.
Well, and the impact of the confusion about rules of engagement, the mission itself, I think plays out in another many sections of the book. But there's one I'd like you to read about your coming, riding in a convoy. And if you can set this up for us, you're in a convoy, and of course part of the mission here is to keep civilian vehicles from driving too close as you're moving up the road.
Right. Convoys are an oppressively constant part of serving in Iraq. You have to move equipment and people from one place to another on a really regular basis, but convoys are targets for the insurgency at all times. And when this particular occurrence had happened, it was not too long after Brian, who's now my husband, had been very seriously injured when he was on another convoy. So, of course, I was a little more keyed up, as I think everyone else probably was, because he had been hurt in one of the first really coordinated attacks outside of Mosul. And when you're in urban driving especially, it's important to not leave too much space between your vehicle and the vehicle in front of you, because a civilian car might pull between the two military vehicles and then try to kill you. So you really want to keep a certain amount of space around your vehicle and not let the civilian cars get too close to you. They're always considered a threat. But people in Iraq drive, they drive crazy, and they would drive in the median on and try to pass from the left, but in the median, in the grass, which I thought was crazy. So at one point, I was a passenger in the rear behind the driver's seat of a Humvee. And obviously, we had no doors at this point because we didn't have up-armored Humvees anyway. So I'm trying to watch my sector and pay attention to what's going on. And there's a car driving very aggressively to my left. The car is not pulling back. He is not getting the message. It's tremendously loud with no doors. No one in the Humvee but me sees this car yet. It's my field of fire. It's my call to decide what to do next. I raise my weapon and point directly into the car. I can feel my adrenaline pumping. I do not know what's going to happen. I will shoot this car if this car is beginning to feel like a threat. My weapon status is red. It's always red on convoys now. My safety is on, though I know some soldiers are not bothering with keeping their weapons on safety anymore. But I do. It's still less than a second. Flip, squeeze. After the first round, I can fire at will. Just then, a passenger on my side turns to look for the first time. It's a little boy, no more than 8 or 9 years old. I'm pointing my weapon at a boy who looks exactly like Rick's little brother. The boy looks at me, looking at him. I lower my rifle and hold it with one hand across my knees. Without thinking, I wave at the boy with my other hand. After a moment, he waves back.
Rick is your former boyfriend, right?
All names have been changed in this book, but
right,
yes.
But that's you're referring to.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And you came awfully close. The red condition that you describe is the highest readiness. In other words, you're ready to shoot. You've got bullets in the chamber.
Yes. You have a magazine and you have a round chambered.
You're ready to go. Did you ever shoot anyone? Had you killed anyone in the war?
I'm thankful that I was never forced to do that.
That seems to be one. Is that something that people worry about? Do soldiers worry? How much do they worry about dying and how much do they worry about killing?
It depends on the soldier, honestly. Of course, everyone is worried about dying. Not so much that they worry about it because you're just doing your job, but you don't want to die. You go over there, you don't think, I want to get killed, but you don't worry about it obsessively. And some soldiers worry and agonize a great deal about having to kill. And there are other soldiers who, I was approached by some 18-year-old kid once who was talking about how much he wanted to shoot someone and see what his weapon would do when the rounds tore into somebody. And I was just horrified to think that, you know, that he really thought that it would be cool to watch what it would be like when his rounds tore into a human being's body. I couldn't help but wonder if he meant that or if he was just kind of blustering and trying to act more confident than he really felt. But many of the people I know who have actually killed people, they struggle with it for a long time afterwards. And sometimes that doesn't even come up right away, not for a long time later. But it's something that people do, you have to live with for the rest of your life.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit more about that and also about the problem of suicide and suicide prevention among soldiers as we continue our conversation with Kayla Williams about her 5 years in the military. She was a linguist in Iraq for a year. Her book, Love My Rifle More Than You. Just ahead, more of your phone calls and our conversation, 877-962-9862 on the State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour with Kayla Williams, author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. The book is an account of her 5 years in the military and her year-long deployment in Iraq. Taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Kayla, before the break, we were talking about the psychological stress of being in combat. Suicide seems to be a pretty serious problem among the troops, or at least one that the military talks about regularly.
Yes, and we would receive quarterly briefings on suicide prevention and how to recognize signs of to be concerned about among fellow troops. It's something that the military has always struggled with. It happens in the civilian population, too, but it's certainly something that I think can be especially frustrating for the military because it is such a tight-knit family in a lot of ways.
Well, you wrote that you actually considered suicide at one point yourself.
It wasn't so much that I was actively considering suicide as that I just didn't really want to keep doing things anymore. I was so drained and exhausted, and there were times that I just didn't know if it was worth keeping going. But, of course, I did go on, and there was a woman in my unit who did choose to kill herself. And it may surprise you, but the first reaction among many of the other soldiers in our unit after shock was anger that she had taken what seemed like the easy way out, and she had only been in Iraq for about 3 weeks. The rest of us had been there for probably six months, and we're like, we've been dealing with all this for so much longer, and we went through combat, and there was just an incredible amount of frustration.
Well, not only among the troops, but the battalion commander then addressed the troops and expressed the same thing.
At her memorial service, which I just couldn't believe. It seemed so incredibly inappropriate at a memorial service to say that she was angry at the soldier for not having reached out for help. And, I mean, I understand that she had this feeling, but the fact that it was expressed at a memorial service and not, you know, between with just her commanders or whatever just absolutely shocked me. I couldn't believe it.
Kayla Williams is my guest. 877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join the conversation. David is on the line from Fort Bragg. Hello, David.
Hello. Yeah. Isn't this a pleasant surprise? How are you doing, Miss Williams?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm out at Camp McCall right now, actually. So sorry about the confusion here. I'm wondering why you seem to be presenting a problem as endemic across the entire United States military, which, you know, I've been in for 17 years, and it appears to be a majority now. It can be an outspoken majority, but it just appears that you're presenting the entire United States military as a bunch of immature locker room schoolboys.
I'm really sorry that you see it that way. I've certainly tried to express the fact that that can be a problem, but that overall I served with a great deal of honorable and outstanding individuals. But it is a problem that does exist, and as I expressed, I'm always surprised that people are shocked by it, because it does happen in the rest of society as well. I wonder if people are shocked because they expect soldiers to be more disciplined and for it to not happen. But it certainly can be a problem in the military. But
I realize that. I'm an equal opportunity representative.
Right.
My next question was, did you report it to your EOR or EOA while you were there?
The incident that was really problematic, I chose to go directly to his supervisor and let his chain of command deal with it internally, and then I chose to write a memorandum for record that would be kept on file in the EO office of his unit, so that if he presented a pattern of behavior that he would suffer for it, but that it would not ruin his career if it were just one incident that he made under extreme duress, that he was just under such stress that he cracked. I wouldn't want to ruin his career, but if he made it a pattern of behavior, I did want it to be seen as part of a larger pattern, and for him to not be able to get away with doing it regularly. And it was a decision I really struggled with. One of the toughest things I think about the issue of sexual harassment in the military is that even when command climate really encourages people to report, the peer pressure to not mess up somebody's career for what was just a joke or not overreact, the pressure from fellow soldiers is extreme.
It can be. It sounds like you did all the right things. I'm going to look forward to finding your book and reading it. You have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, David. 877-962-9862. There were things that you didn't report. You talked about being in an interrogation situation. Describe that for us, where sexual humiliation was part of what you were asked to do.
Yes, that was in one of the most frustrating and difficult experiences that I had in Iraq, because it seemed so out of line with what I was used to as being acceptable in the military. I was asked to assist in an interrogation as a female who spoke Arabic. And foolishly, I thought that this might be to interrogate a female prisoner, that this was a sign of cultural sensitivity. And I agreed to participate and went down to the location where interrogations were taking place. When I got there, I was briefed that it was quite the opposite. I would be expected to sit in a room with several other soldiers, and then a prisoner would be brought in blindfolded and with his hands zip-tied behind his back, and then his clothing would be removed, and then his blindfold, so that I would be the first thing that he saw, and that then we were supposed to humiliate him and mock his manhood in an attempt to break him down psychologically in hopes that he would give up items of intelligence value. I was really disturbed and shocked by what I was being told to participate in. I did go ahead and sit through it, though I didn't feel like I was very good at participating. I've never really sat around and practiced how to mock someone's manhood or humiliate them, humiliate their sexuality from a distance or up close, for that matter. Mm. So I felt quite often like I was more of a prop than anything, just sitting there kind of stunned. And I was horrified to also see some of the other soldiers flicking lit cigarette butts at their prisoners. And although I did sit through it, when it was over, I approached the non-commissioned officer in charge, the NCOIC, of the interrogation, and told him that I thought he was certainly bordering on crossing the Geneva Convention, although I haven't read all of it and am not familiar with interrogation techniques because I was not in human intelligence, that I thought he was bordering on crossing the Geneva Convention, and that he certainly was turning anyone who might possibly have walked in innocent into a terrorist by the time they walked out, and that I was not comfortable ever participating again. And he said he knew and did not ask me to participate again. And the Army did learn that there were problematic things going on very quickly and moved immediately to put new people in charge and fix the problem. So it was really, it was encouraging to see that the system did work. The problem was discovered and solved very, very swiftly. And that was a That's a good thing to see, that the system can work sometimes.
And that was outside of Abu Ghraib.
Yes, this was in Mosul.
That was in Mosul. But also interesting, the response from that officer that you spoke with.
Non-commissioned officer.
An NCO, forgive me, who said, yeah, I know that's part of the response. That what's going to happen is, you know, we're going to create more terrorists, perhaps, than we find in this process.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was stunned. I mean, he was kind of almost smiling while he said it. And I'm not sure if he had just been there too long and kind of something in him had slipped, or if he really truly believed that some possible end would justify these means and that he might possibly get something that would make all of this worthwhile. But certainly everything, I've done some amount of research since then, and from what I've read, techniques like that and even techniques bordering over into torture, aside from the moral implications that they have and the fact that it loses America any moral higher ground and leaves certainly a bad taste in all of our mouths as American civilians, they also just aren't necessarily terribly effective techniques. And it may sound incredibly cold to civilians, but aside from the moral implications, I do think that the effectiveness is an important question to ask.
877-962-9862. We go to the phones, and Raleigh, Tracy is on the line. Hi, Tracy.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Kayla, I wanted to ask, you seem very aware of kind of the larger political issues.
Tracy, we are losing you, but on my screen here, I understand that you might have wanted to ask Kayla why she joined the military, and if that's it, let me ask you, why did you join the Army?
It's always a complicated question to answer. I believe that there are probably about as many reasons to join the Army as there are soldiers in the Army. My reasons were complex, as they are for many people. I was somewhat unusual in that I already had a college degree and was a little older. I already owned a home. I was in a long-term relationship with the Palestinian boyfriend that you mentioned earlier. And my life was going in all the directions that it seems like it's supposed to go in your early 20s. But then I lost my job and was struggling to figure out what I wanted to do. I wanted to continue my education and go on to graduate school, but I didn't want to have to work full-time and go to school full-time or end up with, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loans. And the military offers great educational benefits. I also had a feeling that I had been digging myself a very careful rut and that I had never done anything to really challenge myself or step outside of what I knew I would be good at. And the Army was definitely something I did not know if I would be good at. And it was a way for me to really challenge myself. They were willing to pay me money to learn a foreign language and at the same time give something back to the larger community. I always felt very lucky to have gotten quite a bit out of America and felt that it was an important way for me to try to give something back.
What I can't imagine you can come through an experience without learning a great deal about yourself. What was the biggest surprise that you in learning about yourself?
And that I'm stronger than I ever knew I was, both physically, and that before I joined the Army, I had no idea that I would be able to, you know, run 5 or 7 miles, that I would be able to go on ruck marches, that I could do 55 push-ups in under a minute. I had no idea that my body was capable of doing all of these things. And also that I can survive in a crisis, that I can handle incredible privation and be in difficult and painful circumstances for long periods of time and, you know, maybe bend under the pressure a little bit, but not break and come out stronger in the end. That has been incredibly empowering for me. And I think I will always be proud of what I've done serving my country and what I've gained from it, in addition to what I've been able to give.
Have there been any difficulties in making the adjustment to civilian life?
Constant difficulties in adjusting to civilian life. I don't have a weapon to carry around all the time. I mean, that actually transition was what was hard about coming back to America after being in Iraq. I was still in the Army, but they don't let you carry your weapon around all the time, which is probably a good thing, as keyed up as we usually are coming back, at least lucky for other drivers.
Actually, if you move to Florida, not only can you have the weapon, you can use it if somebody looks at you the wrong way. Turns out. They just, brand new law. But anyway, go ahead.
Wasn't law when I lived in Florida.
Yeah.
it's even since then, it's very difficult to readjust. I still I still swerve to avoid trash in the road when I'm driving sometimes because it might be an IED. My husband and I hate going to see fireworks at the 4th of July because we still can't quite get used to the big bangs. And I just have a sense quite often that I have a hard time communicating with civilians. I feel as if so many Americans just have no idea how rich and how lucky we really are. Coming back from Iraq and after spending time in the military, you know, I've never complained that my husband leaves the toilet seat up. I'm really excited that we have a toilet and indoor plumbing, and I don't care if he leaves the toilet seat up. And this sense of not being able to understand normal people's normal problems and not thinking that they are important, I just feel as if so many people's complaints are really petty and minor and unimportant, and I often have a very difficult time feeling like I can communicate effectively with a lot of civilians, and that's been very hard. It's a lot harder than I thought to leave the military family, in a sense.
Yeah. You mentioned your husband. He suffered a brain injury, and he's still in the service, and you talk a little bit, not in the book, but afterward, about some of the difficulties you've had in getting treatment.
Right, and that's probably one of the things that's made it easiest for me to get out of the Army is the just incredible sense of betrayal that I feel, and I know that he feels as well, that even though he got outstanding care when he was first injured, he was hit by an IED, and the fact that he survived and that he walks and talks and is generally doing, I mean, incredibly well considering the severity of his injuries, we're incredibly lucky and very grateful to the doctors that gave him that great care when he was first injured. But he was injured in October of 2003, and it is now October of 2005, and he has not been medically retired from the Army yet. They've lost his paperwork, just kind of shuffled him through the system. They keep telling us that he has slipped through the cracks, and he hasn't got any sort of rehabilitation, and all of these things are just incredibly frustrating. I get the sense that the system is a little overwhelmed.
Do you get that sense? Have you talked with others in a similar situation? Is this a common problem?
I think it's an incredibly widespread problem, yes. More soldiers are surviving with more severe injuries in this conflict than any previous conflict because of the increases in battlefield technology. We have better protectant gear with flak vests and Kevlars. We have helicopters to get people to better treatment more quickly. More soldiers have been trained on emergency first aid, combat lifesaver training. And all of these things are great. They also mean that soldiers are coming back with incredibly severe injuries that would have killed them in previous wars. And I think the traumatic brain injury question alone is a huge one for this conflict in particular, because many people, even if their main injury may be something else, they still suffer some sort of brain injury from the concussion of an explosion. And people are still trying to figure out exactly what that does to a human being and how to deal with the aftermath. And I've just been horribly disappointed to see the fact that my husband, who nearly gave his life serving his country, has not been treated as well as I always was led to believe the Army would treat an injured soldier.
Kayla Williams, we are out of time, but I want to thank you very much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Kayla Williams, author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. That's the state of things for today. Thank you very much for listening. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Frank Stachow.